What is there to say on a Monday following a Philadelphia 76ers loss, yet another early playoff exit, just days away from coming to pass? What is there to say? Can we get into this with happiness? Is there a way to bring some Russ joy to the morning? Do we just have a moment where we all let it out? Everybody yells, everybody screams, it's very cathartic. What's the way to go about this on a Monday? I'm going to tell you how. We have a moment here on Crossing Broadcast, everybody's favorite Philadelphia sports podcast. And we're just going to take a moment of silence right now for yet another blown opportunity by your team, your town, your Philadelphia 76ers. And we're going to talk about context. We're going to talk about how Game 4 went down. We're going to talk about how this whole Sixers season has gone down, how this Joel Embiid era has gone down, how whatever the fuck Daryl Morey does for a living has gone down. We're going to talk about all that in a minute. And we're not going to ignore it. And I see David Berkowitz over here saying we ignore it. We're not ignoring it because somebody has to hold these people accountable. So join me here. We're going to take about 10 seconds. Let's have a moment of silence for your team, your town, your Philadelphia 76ers. We'll do a postmortem on it later this week. I'm pretty sure of it. But before we do, let's just take a moment of silence and think about some of the good memories and the good moments that we've had this year with the Philadelphia 76ers. So join me for the next 10 seconds. And that's it. That's it. That's all they get. I shouldn't have even given them the full 10 seconds. They can't give us a full 48 minutes. They can't give us the entirety of their game. Why do we give them the full, gracious 10 seconds? I don't know. I have to tell you that there have been times where I've watched a Philadelphia 76ers team and I've watched them underperform, or we've seen early exits from the playoffs, and you sit back and you say, well, if X or Y had gone differently, or if maybe you had a different guy in a spot, a guy misses a shot, you have a weird Kawhi Leonard bounce on the rim, maybe that's the year that you make a run. Ben Simmons injuries, Markelle Fultz having thoracic outlet syndrome, Joel Embiid breaking his face twice, three times, whatever it is at this point, him breaking his foot, the navicular bone. Gastroenteritis still hasn't happened. It's entirely possible that it could happen before Game 5. But you look at all of the things that this fan base has gone through, and that doesn't even include things away from the court. That doesn't include Burnergate. That doesn't include Sam Hinkie being forced out of town. That doesn't include the installation of Jerry Colangelo and then the nepotism hire of Brian Colangelo. It has nothing to do with any of that. You look at, like, there are times where you sit back and say, like, can we just have one season? Can we just have one run where things don't go wrong? Or at least if something goes wrong, that it's a normal wrong. And the Philadelphia 76ers can't do it. They can't. And if you paid attention to the Flyers, you know, the Flyers have also had some really weird shit happen, without a doubt, bar none. But what the Sixers have done is they have effectively taken the most talented player that has played for this franchise in decades, and they have once again squandered a year of what is potentially his prime. Now, he is not without fault. He is not infallible. He didn't go out and have himself a majestic game. The fourth quarter is looming large, not only in Game 4, but elsewhere in the series. But we're going to get back to him in a second. If you're a Sixers fan, what you saw, what went wrong in Game 4, is due in large part not to the head coach, not to Nick Nurse, not to his tactics, not to his rotations. It's not even, for the most part, on Joel Embiid. It's not necessarily on Tyrese Maxey for knowing that Kyle Lowry is going to intentionally miss a free throw. It's on roster construction. And it's once again on, you can put the blame at the feet of Elton Brand. You can put the blame at the feet of Daryl Morey. You can put it on their predecessors. It doesn't really matter. This team has now found itself in a very similar position to where the Sixers of a few decades ago did with Allen Iverson, where you have an MVP talent and a front office that is not capable of surrounding him with the talent needed to make a legitimate run at a title and to have year-over-year sustained success. It's there again. Iverson is a very different player than Joel Embiid. Iverson was a far less efficient player than Joel Embiid. Iverson played through a lot of injuries. A lot of them you didn't know about. A lot of them weren't reported until the end of the year. Some of them never were actually reported in totality until he retired. Joel Embiid, because of how social media works, because of how leaks happen, we know virtually everything that goes wrong with Joel Embiid's body. Everything. The knee, the flap of the meniscus, when he does have gastroenteritis. Bell's palsy. This guy's under a microscope. He gave you a 50-point effort the other day. He was due in, you know, the win was due in large part to him, almost entirely between him and Tyrese Maxey. So I'm going to give him, for three quarters of yesterday's game, a pass. But this team, when you look at what they have available around him and what Daryl Morey, who is a front office guy who's been long thought of as one of the best in the business, one of the most talented and gifted front office executives when it comes to identifying talent in the league, finding guys off the scrap heap, turning them into potential stars, putting them in advantageous positions, working with the coaching staff to figure out and to identify what will fit best for that coach's system, Daryl Morey has underwhelmed. And game four, and this series really in totality, is an example of exactly why it is such a problem to have an executive that doesn't get it done. Now, you can take the old Kyle Scott route of asking, what has Daryl Morey won? And to some extent, that's fair. He has built teams that have been title contenders. He has built teams that are star-studded. He hitched his wagon to James Harden. It didn't work. They got out from under that deal, but they didn't bring an impact player back. Game four is one of those times where not even having an impact player, but having a decent enough player would have been enough. And in this series, and we'll talk about this, but the Knicks are a good team. They're a cohesive team. They are full of role players who know what to do and execute when they are called upon to do exactly what they need to do. Daryl Morey, since he has been in Philadelphia, has not been able to put together a coherent plan and to put together a roster that is capable of getting the best out of and benefiting from playing with Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey. He has not done it. Now, again, is it Daryl Morey? Is it Elton Brand? Is it someone else we don't know about? Is it Josh Harris having influence at the ownership level? I don't know. But this is a legitimate issue. And Craig, bring it back up. Craig pulls a couple of tweets from the maestro from the last few years. But, you know, people compare, and there he says, Morey's been compared to, you know, like a Billy Bean, a TED-talking GM, and then even last year. Going to continue to get a pass for inheriting game seven of round two and improving none in 3 years. I don't know how you can defend Daryl Morey at this point. And again, we're going to talk about Joel Embiid in a little bit. And we'll talk about Tyrese Maxey not knowing what was happening on the Kyle Lowry shot, the free throw. But those are two players. They are only two. There's an entire team. This team is not well constructed. That Knicks team, I mean, look, if you were to switch Tyrese Maxey and Jalen Brunson, that team probably still gives you a real run. The Knicks aren't even playing at full strength. Arguably, the Knicks' second-best player, Julius Randle, isn't playing in the series. And yet, they've built a cohesive roster that has legitimate role players that all of a sudden, they're going to upend, and I know it's not an upset, but in the fairest of terms, it is an upset. This Knicks team doesn't have the same kind of top-tier potential in terms of their top two players as a healthy Joel Embiid and a healthy Tyrese Maxey. And yet, because there is better depth and guys who know what their roles are and are capable of executing those roles, the Knicks are going to advance. And it's a shame. It genuinely is a shame. Because this was the perfect year for the Sixers to go on a run. They didn't have the pressure of being the number one seed in the conference or the number two seed in the conference. They could play the underdog card. They could play a Knicks team that when you stack them up, a healthy Joel Embiid or mostly healthy Joel Embiid, a rock-solid Tyrese Maxey, and a few veterans who can actually like get the job done. And oh, by the way, $39 million Tobias Harris, who you would hope would pull his head out of his ass for long enough to be able to contribute something in a meaningful way. They should have been able to take down this Knicks team. And yet they couldn't. So, Craig, bring up what you have pulled up there, stat-wise, from Game 4. Kelly Oubre showed up. Is Kelly Oubre a perfect player? No. But he showed up. He did most of what he was supposed to do. He contributed 19 points to the cause. There have been boneheaded moments where you see why Kelly Oubre wasn't a guy that a lot of teams wanted to go after. And at the same time, you can see why he's been so vital to the team this year. Kyle Lowry, he didn't have a big points game. Kyle Lowry's a pest. He gives you good minutes. He created that off-ball foul late in the game that got you a free throw and possession. Lowry also executed about as well as you could on the missed free throw. It's just that his teammates apparently didn't realize that he was going to miss it on purpose. Can't blame him. Nick Batum, we saw the Nick Batum game. And when it happened, we said, that is not going to happen again. Nick Batum plays 21 minutes, gives you a single point, was decent enough on the boards. Campaign, who had a really good game in Game 3, virtually non-existent, didn't have a ton of time. Buddy Hield doesn't even exist. DeAnthony Melton doesn't really exist. B-ball Paul played 4 minutes in the game. A lot of people were clamoring to re-sign B-ball Paul last year. They did. When B-ball Paul didn't play, I was one of the people who said Doc Rivers is an idiot. How can't you get this guy some valuable minutes to like actually try to contribute to the cause? Well, clearly, Nick Nurse also doesn't believe in Paul Reed or doesn't believe in his ability to contribute in a meaningful way, and instead will play 34 minutes of Tobias Harris instead. Now, I can't relitigate Tobias Harris anymore, all right? We are the one good silver lining in this season coming to an end. The only good thing that you can look forward to about the Sixers being done sooner than expected yet again is that we are one game closer to Tobias Harris never suiting up as a Philadelphia 76er ever again. About getting that $39 million cap hit off the books and about being able to either go out and get another star caliber player, whether that's a Paul George, who is a question mark in his own right, or going out and getting some legitimate role players on this team who can actually hit a shot and who aren't afraid to shoot the ball. And that is part of the problem. They once again went into a postseason with a lot of question marks and not a lot of guarantees. The one thing that we knew is that Joel Embiid wasn't going to be able to stay healthy. We all knew it. And it is part of the price of doing business when Joel Embiid is your best player, is you know that he will not be healthy. And that when the cards are down, he will have a good game, maybe even a great game, but he will be hurt. And at some point, a boneheaded decision in the fourth quarter is bound to happen. But what Joel Embiid did in the fourth quarter of Game 4 is inexcusable. Joel Embiid no-showed. It's one thing to be a foul merchant. It's another, you know, it's one of these things to be like a free throw merchant, which is what everybody outside of Philadelphia calls Joel Embiid. He didn't contribute in a meaningful way in the fourth quarter. And I said on this show 2 weeks ago, last week, probably even longer than that, I asked the question, I posited the question to all of you out there. Game on the line, who gets the ball in their hands, Tyrese Maxey or Joel Embiid? And I said, without a doubt, twice on Sunday, it is 100% Tyrese Maxey. Did Maxey make sensational decisions the entire game? Was Maxey an infallible player yesterday? No, he wasn't, but he's also young. And I do think that there's still that star potential for Tyrese Maxey. I think he's got a good head on his shoulders. I think that he's shown a lot of maturity. And I think he's been called upon to take on a role that James Harden was supposed to play. And I think he's done it admirably. He is not a perfect player. I'm not going to say that he's a top four guard in the league. What I will say is I think that he is a significant piece of what the next chapter of whatever the hell this is with the Philadelphia Sixers, 76ers is. But I saw a lot of people slandering Tyrese Maxey yesterday. I'm not here for it. Saw a lot of people going after him for not knowing what was going on with the Kyle Lowry missed free throw. That's fair to a point. He's also the youngest guy on the court at that point. And he wasn't the only one to make the mistake. I think they said, did they say Tobias or it was Kelly? One of them were also out around the arc. And they also didn't seem to crash in knowing that the miss was coming. So there was a miscommunication there. Do you put it on Kyle Lowry? Do you put it on Nick Nurse? I don't know. Joel Embiid not showing up in the fourth quarter is a problem. Joel Embiid talking about the Olympics, not last night, but talking about playing in the Olympics this summer. If you're the Sixers ownership, if you're Josh Harris and you can actually pay attention to anything and you're able to kind of pull your head out of your ass from long enough from the commies, Keister, if you're Sixers ownership, you can't tell him he can't play in the Olympics, but I would not want to see him anywhere near the Olympics. You already have a distressed asset, which actually Harris is very good at selling off or at purchasing and then turning into value. But you already have a guy who can't stay healthy for a regular season, can't stay healthy to make it into the playoffs, and now he's going to go off and play in the Olympics. You're going to add more miles to already rickety knees. You're going to add more miles to a body that continues to break down more than, like, your mother-in-law's 1996 Volkswagen Rabbit. Like, that's the goal. That's the point. Like, you're okay with it. And if you're a Sixers fan, do you want to watch Joel Embiid play for the United States of America in the Olympics? I don't. I want to see Joel Embiid go away for a while. I don't need the Ben Simmons hype video. I need to know that Joel Embiid is somehow going to get himself back in basketball shape and is going to get relatively healthy. But the problem, and Rico actually asks a very good question here. Rico asks on YouTube, do we get that star and just sit Embiid for three quarters of the season? No, because it doesn't work. The Clippers are going through the same thing, and they've been going through the same thing since they acquired Kawhi Leonard. It's the price of doing business with an injured star like this. Kawhi Leonard, when he's healthy, has the talent to be an MVP candidate and maybe even to be an MVP in the league. And he's won titles with the Spurs and with the Raptors. Joel Embiid, when healthy, has the ability, and we've seen it, to be a league MVP and to potentially, although we don't know because he's never fucking done it in the playoffs, he has the ability to lead a team deep into the playoffs. It often feels like with Joel Embiid, a lot of the same thing that dogged Allen Iverson. The supporting cast just isn't good enough. When Joel Embiid goes out and puts up 50 and Maxey puts up, what was it the other day, 25, 30, whatever it was, like, that's great. And your top two players, you expect them to put up the bulk of the points. You expect them to be involved with the ball in their hands more than anyone else in the game. But you have to be able to rely on a set of role players that you can lean on. You go back to, like, some of the Spurs teams that had Tim Duncan, right? So, like, let's go with the idea of playing around a big, which, again, like, I don't think that you can build a team in this NBA and go through the traditional center like Joel Embiid is supposed to be. Like, he is built, he's physically built to be the guy who bangs in the block, gets to the line. It's great that he can stretch the defense sometimes and hit his shot from downtown, that he has a really reliable free throw line J. That's great. You can't build through the center position. Nikola Jokic is the lone outlier. He is an anomaly for a reason. Nikola Jokic is not only an incredible player, he has next-level court vision. He not only detects when a double team's coming, he's already planned on what he's going to do three different ways before it even sets into place. Jokic is an absolute unicorn. He doesn't apply to this conversation. Joel Embiid, while he is fantastic and has MVP caliber play, has the talent, he can't be a guy that you're building around long term. And he's certainly not a guy that you can even try to fathom playing every other game or sitting for three quarters of the year. It doesn't work. It'd be great if it could, but it doesn't work. And that, again, is why this is such a shame. They're going to lose this series to the Knicks. And if you look at who they, in theory, would play in the next round, it's the Pacers, because they just went up 3-1 over a Giannis-less Bucks team coached by Glenn Rivers. Like, you had that matchup coming next. And listen, the Pacers have been really good, and the Pacers have done a great job of matching up well and executing, and they have a lot of guys who fit roles, who execute, if that sounds familiar. And they've been able to take down, for the most part, 3 out of 4 games, one win to go. They've been able to take down Giannis's Bucks, who, by the way, also have Dame Lillard. He's a fantastic player in his own right. Not as good as he was in Portland, but still a very good player. That was lining up perfectly. Miami was, I think we all kind of knew that Miami was going to give Boston at least a little bit of a run, a little bit of a scare. There's a little bit of PTSD there. But without Jimmy Butler, we knew that Boston was going to advance. This was setting up well for you to at least get to the conference finals. You were finally going to be able to get the monkey off your back of being able to get through the second round and potentially punch your ticket to the NBA finals. Now, I'm not going to go full revisionist history here and make it sound like, oh, yeah, the Sixers were the favorite to get out of the Eastern Conference. I've said since day one, buzzsaw. The Celtics are a buzzsaw. They will murder anyone in the conference. There was no chance of anybody getting past Boston. Jimmy Butler with the Heat, a healthy Jimmy Butler, maybe takes them to six or seven games. Maybe things get a little bit weird. But no, I don't think anybody ever imagined that a Cleveland or an Orlando would be able to upset Boston. If this Knicks team advances, if this Knicks team gets through the second round, do I think that the Knicks could match up pretty well with Boston and give them a longer series than desired for Boston? Probably. But again, it's a shame because you did have the ability. When you look at year-over-year growth, you want to be able to show your fan base something that they can hang on to. You want to give your fan base something they can believe in for the next year. If the Sixers had won this series, if the Sixers had then gone on to beat what will probably be the Indiana Pacers in round two, they could at least say, we lost to the best team, arguably, in the league in the Boston Celtics. We lost in the conference finals, but we got to the conference finals, and we're one piece away, and then that's where you go out and you try to make your Paul George move and kind of gloss over the fact that Paul George has had, you know, plenty of injury issues on his own. And you say, like, that's the step. And then you can sell the fan base next year that we were one piece away. Paul George is exponentially more impactful than Tobias Harris ever was. And you can sell your fan base on it. You go into next year and you feel like there's momentum behind the team. But instead, you've gone backwards. And you've once again ended a season where Joel Embiid is hurt. Joel Embiid's cast around him, no showed in large part. The one good thing that you have, I haven't seen it. I could be wrong. I don't think I am. I haven't seen a lot of people questioning Nick Nurse. I haven't seen a lot of people shitting on Nick Nurse the way that they did on Glenn Rivers before. I think Nick Nurse is a really good coach. I think he's trying to maximize the most out of what he can with what he's been given, with the tools he's been given. We can even say he's got a little bit of torts in him. And that, like, he is squeezing the most juice he can out of this fruit. He's getting the most blood out of this stone. But there's only so much you can do. Now, listen, we'll do a full post-mortem on the Sixers when they're officially dead. And is it possible, like, I'll throw this out, and I'm sure that there are going to be people who are going to think it's a joke, and it kind of is, maybe a little bit. But the fact that the Sixers still have the best player in the series, when he's healthy, he's not now. But the fact that they have the best player in the series, potentially, the guy who has won the MVP, and the fact that they do have a young stud guard who can, on many nights, line up pretty well, blow for blow with Jalen Brunson, is there a scenario where the Sixers can win three straight? Maybe. I'm not going to say they can't. But they're going to need so much from the rest of that supporting cast that we have just not seen. So you'd be stupid to put your money on it. Can you set your heart on it? Can you believe as a Sixers fan that maybe Tobias Harris finds some sort of dignity that has long been left on the ground? Does he pick it up? Does he play with some fire? Does he play for that next contract? If he does, then maybe the series goes six games. Like, maybe they are able to put a little bit of a scare in New York at MSG. Maybe they are able to force a game six. Hell, maybe they play well in game six and the role players come back. The problem is, I don't think you're winning two out of three at MSG. And again, I don't think that the rest of the team has done enough to show you that they have the ability or the temerity to get through these next few games. And I see this too. David Berkowitz saying the officiating would never let it happen. Can't fucking blame the refs. Can't always blame the refs. Has the officiating in this series been good? No. Has it sucked? Largely. Do we actually sit down and say, like, without a doubt, officiating is intentionally screwing the Sixers? No, I think that's silly. Is it better for the league for the Knicks to have a legitimate team and for the New York market to be involved? Maybe. But on the flip side, you could argue just as much that having a former MVP who could potentially go on a collision course with another former MVP and Nikola Jokic in the finals would be good for business as well. But it is a shame. I'm disappointed. I'm sure that you're all disappointed too. So now we can move on to something a little bit happier, if that's okay. Now, if we all just want to end the show after that, we all would just want to go off on our Monday and set the stage with a really depressing show and then wait for Thursday when Kinker's back and have a wonderful moment, then that's fine. But I think I'd like to get to something a little bit happier, just a little bit happier, because I love bringing just a little bit of joy to start the week, okay? Let's go to the draft. Now, I've said this a bunch of times, and Craig, if you can pull up the list of picks, that would be sensational. But I said this on Thursday's show, and I think I said it on last Monday's show. There are a lot of people that bother me because there are people who they present themselves as like some form of a draft expert. And you get some hosts on radio who kind of bloviate and act like they've been watching footage from the Mac and they've been watching footage from every conference all year, that they've been personally scouting Quinyon Mitchell, that they've been personally scouting Jeremiah Trotter Jr., and that they know better than anyone else what he brings to the table. That's not me, okay? I'll give you some thoughts. I'll give you some higher-level takeaways. I'll give you some, like, thoughts on the draft as a whole. But I'm not going to sit here and act like I sat down and I watched Cooper or that I watched a ton of Jalix Hunt. I didn't. Did you? I don't know. There are other places that you go for your detailed analysis of the college prospects coming out. What we said on Thursday is that, or Friday, is that Mitchell fits a need. Corners drafted in the first round can be iffy, but that what he showed in the Senior Bowl and what he showed leading up to the Senior Bowl, being willing to take on the best and the brightest at the wide receiver position that week, was at a next level, that Mike Tomlin noted it, that it was brought up on the draft coverage by Nick Saban, that Nick Saban said he wanted Mitchell to go into the transfer portal, but Mitchell wanted to stay, you know, loyal to Toledo. Those are all good anecdotes. We have no idea what he's going to look like at the next level. He has a very good corner, or a guy who at least was a very good corner in that DB room with Darius Slay. James Bradbury, as Connor Allen notes, Bradbury, your time is up. I think it's been pretty clear that James Bradbury, unfortunately, like the bottom fell out last year. And it was a shame because he was being relied upon heavily to be the guy that he was prior to giving up the touchdown in the Super Bowl. You remember, we don't have to go down that PTSD path. But Mitchell seems to fit a need, and there are a lot of good things about the guy away from just the X's and O's that give you hope. Cooper falling was great in the second round. That was a guy that had some legitimate first-round buzz, and it kind of felt like, wow, Howie season again. He figured out a way to get another first-round talent, but pick him up in the second round. Looks like he's going to play safety. Is it possible that they can look to the slot for him? Like, maybe. But you've now addressed a legitimate position of need in the defensive backfield with two guys that were viewed as legitimate first-round picks. That's good. I don't see either of them getting Darius Slay out of the starting lineup. Could one of them push for the Bradbury spot? Maybe. You also have Avante Maddox coming back. We know you have CJGJ in the safety room. We'll see. Did they address linebacker in a meaningful way? They did with Hunt. Now, do I believe that a third-round linebacker is going to be a legitimate starter at the NHL or the NFL level right now? I don't know. Couldn't tell you. The one good thing for Jalix Hunt is that this team doesn't address the linebacker position, so it's not like there are a lot of incumbents that have done a sensational job of holding down that spot. So he'll be given an opportunity to compete. But what exactly was the competition he was facing at a Houston Christian? I don't know. Could he be coached up? Sure. It's possible. I have no idea. The Will Shipley pick was interesting because it felt like they were trying to find their own version of Christian McCaffrey. Speedy, versatile, white running back. Does anybody think that Shipley is going to do anything to really contribute in a meaningful way in his first year? You would certainly hope not, right? Because your hope is that Saquon Barkley is a three-down back, and he's going to give you all the production and more that you ever hoped he would be able to. Could Shipley kind of take the Boston Scott role as the change of pace back? Maybe. Could you run a bunch of two-back sets and have your downhill guy in Barkley and then have this more versatile guy who can really play a meaningful role in the receiving game? Like, yeah, maybe. So Shipley seems fine. Anaya Smith was another guy that, like, the draft pundits seemed to believe was taken a little bit later than anticipated. Your guess is as good as mine. The good thing, I guess, is that, you know, you take a receiver that late, but he's not being expected to come in and play any kind of important role on the team because you've locked up A.J. Brown. You've locked up Devontae Smith. I'm a little bit surprised they didn't look at a linebacker, or it's not a linebacker, a tight end at some point earlier in the draft. I think that you need to have a Dallas Goedert insurance plan. They haven't really done it. David Berkowitz asks over on YouTube, is Gainwell on the bubble now? I don't know. That's why I said, like, I think that Shipley kind of fits more of the mold of the change of pace guy that, like, Boston Scott has been. I don't know. I think what the one good thing that we'll know is they're going to have four guys, with Shipley included, that are going to be in that room that you're going to think are probably NFL caliber players. And that's where Kellen Moore coming in with a fresh set of eyes could really tell you a lot about what to expect this season. So they're not going to run four backs on game day, though. And then they got Jeremiah Trotter Jr. in the fifth round. They traded up. They got the Axeman's son. Saw a lot of people very excited about it. He played for Clemson. You bring back the guy to be the second generation Eagle. A lot of people very excited about Jeremiah Trotter Jr. All I'm going to say is that if his name was Malcolm Jones, no one would have cared. Do I know if Jeremiah Trotter Jr. is a sensational talent? No. Do I think that it's more likely than not that people are overrating the pick because his dad was one of the best Eagles, or at least best Eagles defensive players of all time? I do. I think that there's just a lot of overrating. But he could be good. I have no clue. Listen, if nothing else, they drafted two linebackers. And it, again, you're going into a room where there are plenty of openings and plenty of guys that can compete for spots. And maybe one of these guys step up and they give you something more than you thought that they would. Again, like N'Kobe Dean, very good player in college, has not been able to stay healthy, is undersized. Could Hunt, could Trotter. Could they make the starting lineup? Maybe. Could they at least be a rotational piece? You would hope so. But once you get to the fifth round, like, I don't know. People always like to point to the anomalies. Oh, this guy was taken in the fifth. This guy was taken in the sixth. Nobody thought he'd be anything. Now he's an all-pro. It happens, but there's a reason that it's easy to point to those guys, because they're anomalies. They're not the rule of thumb. So I'm not going to get overly excited about either of these guys. You hope that one of them stands out at least in training camp, and you found yourself a stud later in the draft. They went and got Trevor Keegan in the fifth round. I think that they needed to address offensive line. I think I said this on Friday's show, but like, you come out of this draft and I don't think you feel any better about having a potential contingency plan for Lane Johnson, which I do think is a problem. I think that next year's draft, that's going to have to be the point of focus, I think. I think you do need to add another tackle to this team. Because when they've lost Lane Johnson historically, things have gotten exponentially worse for Jalen Hurts. So I do think that at some point, if you're not going to go after a guy in free agency, which they didn't, and if you're not going to go after a guy high in this draft, next year, that almost assuredly has to be the position you're going to go after. You have Jordan Mailata on the other side, who's been incredible. He's been one of those anomalies, a late pick who turns into one of the highest paid players at the position. That's awesome. But you are going to have to build a contingency plan. Like, I don't know if you've noticed, a lot of Lane Johnson's contemporaries have all retired, or in the case of Brandon Graham, like on that final victory lap. You need to at some point plan on having somebody who can kind of take over, and they don't have that guy in the room right now. And then Johnny Wilson and Dylan McMahon, I have no idea. None. I stopped paying attention to the draft after the fifth. I don't know what either of these guys are. All the best to them. No clue. Is Johnny Wilson exciting from Florida State? I have no idea. Is Dylan from NC State going to be like the heir apparent at center? You hope not. That's what you brought Cam Jurgens in to be. So, I don't know. How do we feel about the draft? Let me know in the comments below. If you're over on YouTube, let me know what you think. David Berkowitz says that they viewed Wilson like a tight end. Okay, then that's fine. If that's true, then great. I guess. Listen, if you lose Dallas Goedert for a significant portion of the season again, things aren't great. They don't really have a contingency plan there right now. I always worry when you like when you go into a season and you have incredibly limited depth at a really important position, tight end, tackle, linebacker, if we're being fair. I always worry about what happens when that one guy goes out. I know that you can't be incredibly deep at every position. I know that, like, that's what championship organizations strive for. But in fairness, like, I don't know where you guys land on it, but I would have loved to have seen them go after a tackle, and I'd probably like to see them actually go after a legitimate tight end. And if this guy ends up blossoming into being like a decent enough backup tight end, a good insurance plan in case Goddard misses a game, swell. But let me know in the comments what you think of the draft this weekend. I think it was fine. Again, they addressed position of need with their first two picks that hopefully will be mentored. Darius Slay said on Twitter, and we talked about this on Friday, but Darius Slay said on Twitter last week that he was going to essentially take Mitchell under his wing, and that the goal was for him to eventually replace Slay. That's the whole point. David Berkowitz says on YouTube, A+ for Howie. He knows what needs to be done after last year's debacle. Here's the one good thing. I'm gonna give everybody one positive, okay? Because I need something positive today, all right? We got a lot of negativity with the Sixers. Let's go positive here. Big picture with the Eagles. This is the first draft that you've had with Kellen Moore as the offensive coordinator and Vic Fangio as the defensive coordinator. And one has to think that those guys were a huge part of scouting and deciding which players in this draft would best fit their respective systems. And to that end, I'm willing to give it a shot. I'm willing to give them even more of a blank slate than I have when Howie's had some questionable picks in the past, because ultimately it's not just one guy who makes that decision. It's not just one guy who does all the scouting. So we'll go into it with a little bit of belief that Kellen Moore and Vic Fangio know what they're looking for and that they're going to be able to maximize these guys to the best of their abilities. Also, I forget who it was. I think it was Hunt was the one who, when he got the call from Howie Roseman, called him Big Pimpin'. Love that. Never thought we'd hear Howie Roseman referred to as Big Pimpin', but here we are. Hey, there was another little bit of football news outside of the Eagles, and it's that there's a big change happening with the CBS NFL crew. So if you've been watching, I don't know, let me know in the comments too. I want to know what you watch on game day, which pregame show you watch. Do you stick to, and like, let's take the Eagles out of it, all right? So we're going to rule out the Jacob Media one. We're going to rule out the NBC Sports Philly pregame show, not Eagles specific. Like, if you're watching a national game where the Eagles aren't playing, are you watching the Fox show? Are you watching ESPN NFL Countdown? Are you watching CBS? Which one do you gravitate to? When I was growing up, I always watched the Fox telecast. So, like, JB and Howie Long and Terry Bradshaw, like, that was my jam. The CBS crew, like, I don't know. Maybe it's just because, like, where I grew up, the Steelers always played on CBS. And even though in Pottsville you were allowed to be a Pittsburgh fan and a Philadelphia fan, I didn't really like watching games on CBS. But now I don't know. Well, anyway, CBS is making a change. We're seeing people here. Jamie says NFL Network in the morning, followed by Fox. Got other people saying they don't watch any of them. Jump around. Joe Papel wants to snow the goalie Eagles pregame press row show. Can tell you that won't happen unless somebody pays us Boku bucks, in which case Aunt Bundy and I will be all over it with an Eagles pregame show. But CBS is making a really big change. So Front Office Sports put this out a little bit ago, but Boomer Esiason and Phil Sims are out at CBS. Matt Ryan is in, which means that next season, when you turn on the NFL on CBS, you're going to be greeted by the friendly face and voice of James Brown, Nate Burleson, and Bill Cowher. They've been there. They're going to continue to be there. J.J. Watt, and now Matt Ryan. Matt Ryan on the desk. Feels like a push to get younger. Certainly feels like that. Boomer, I think, is still working at FAN in New York. I think he still has one of the prime radio shifts there. I don't know if it has anything to do with that. Don't know if he's maybe going to move on to like the Amazon pregame show. It'll be interesting to see if anything changes there. Where does Phil Sims land? No clue. No idea. Is Phil Sims ready to get out? Are they both ready to get out? I think I saw Phil Sims put out a tweet that like this chapter's over, but there'll probably be something to come. So I don't know if anybody cares. But I think at some point you do have to kind of overhaul the show a little bit. With Fox, it was when they added Michael Strahan. that kind of felt like this big seismic shift for that show. I do think that at some point you either have to get younger or you have to get a little bit different. Give us something that's different from what we've all gotten used to. So to that end, I actually think that the CBS crew, like if you're in your early 30s like me, you probably are more interested to hear what a Nate Burleson and a J.J. Watt and a Matt Ryan have to say. Will Matt Ryan do really well on TV? I think he probably will. Do I think he's going to be the most compelling guy? No. Do I think that what's going to be interesting about Matt Ryan goes beyond just having like the dynamic personality? Yeah, I think that Matt Ryan will probably be able to take you into the mind and the eyes of a modern-day quarterback better than Boomer and Phil Sims. I do think that Matt Ryan's going to be able to kind of give you more of that, this era of what it is to be a quarterback, and break the game down from that vantage point. I'll give it a watch. We'll see. All right, last thing. It's not the Flyers. We're not talking about the Flyers today. There's been no big Flyers news, to my knowledge, unless I'm very wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm not. We're not breaking down the Union. No, we're going to talk really briefly about the Philadelphia Phillies, who have been on an absolute tear, have won four straight games. But by God, couldn't we just keep the rotation as it was? All right, Spencer Turnbull looked like a stud. All right, he was doing great. He was playing better. He was pitching better than at any point in his career. Love Spencer Turnbull. Is it because he got me a couple of wins for my fantasy team? It might be. Am I upset that Taiwan Walker's back primarily because it means that Spencer Turnbull is out of my rotation in fantasy and now I have to go find another guy? That is entirely possible. But I'm disclosing it to all of you because it matters. But Taiwan Walker, the up and down Taiwan Walker, returned to the rotation on Sunday, had a decent enough start to the game, but was left in the seventh inning and it kind of blew up in the way that you sort of expected it to. And there are times where I feel like, you know, just like anybody else does, when a front office decides to invest significant money in a player, sometimes they try to force a square peg into a round hole because they just don't want to take on the either embarrassment or the acknowledgement that like maybe it wasn't a good signing, or they don't want to have to push off a guy returning, or they don't want to have him, you know, get more rehab starts in the minors. But I put this out yesterday. Taiwan Walker stinks. He does. He's not particularly good. He's never been particularly reliable. And when the Phillies signed him from the Mets fans were rejoicing in the streets that they didn't have to deal with Taiwan Walker's inefficiency and about his erratic ability on the mound. Taiwan Walker's fine, but he's not very good. But anyway, the Phillies have won 11 of 13. Spencer Turnbull's out of the rotation. Maybe Taiwan Walker has a couple more blow-ups and they go back to my guy Spencer Turnbull. And I can feel really good about it. I can get my fantasy team back in the win column. He's been big. Alec Bohm, though, you know, we talked about a couple weeks ago about how things have been iffy with some of the guys on this team. And you look back at a guy like Alec Bohm, who was really, really rough until about 2 weeks ago. He was only hitting .237 through mid-April. And all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, he's got a .365 average. And here, look at this. Big Bet Bob. Let's go to Big Bet Bob over on the Twitter. So Alec Bohm, after going on an absolute spree with a .521 batting average over his last 12 games, he's now up to a .365 batting average, which is first among third basemen in the majors, not just the NL, in the majors. His .441 on-base percentage is tops. .615 slugging percentage, tops. He's tops in OPS, has the most doubles over that time, 12. Okay? 17 extra base hits, first for third baseman. 26 RBI, first for third baseman. He's on an absolute tear. Could we make the case that right now Alec Bohm is playing at an MVP level? Yeah, over the last 2 weeks or so, that's a fair assessment. Is Alec Bohm going to be a legitimate MVP candidate this year? No, absolutely not. But what we do know about this team and what we knew about it coming into the season is that if the guys who were actually paid to hit the ball did so, this team could put up some really, really crooked numbers. And they have. they have over the last few weeks. They've done a great job. The lineup, the bats are heating up. We talked about the fact last week that Trey Turner's kind of on this MVP season of his own. Now you've got Alec Bohm giving you legitimate production from third. As a team, they're 12th overall in runs in Major League Baseball at 4.66. They have the most home runs in the National League. The bats have come around. We can all feel good about it. The pitching has been sensational, right? Like we talked about this last week as well. Ranger Suarez has pitched out of his mind. Turnbull was pitching really well. Nola's had some good starts. Wheeler's had good starts. This team as a whole, this rotation as a whole, has done a very good job. And Christopher Sanchez, they've done a very good job of keeping their team in games and sometimes even just being an absolute shutdown staff. But the bats coming alive is the big thing, right? Because when this team was struggling a few weeks ago, I said one of two things has to happen. And if the pitching is struggling, the bats have to wake up. What's happening early in the season is the pitching was keeping them in a lot of games and the bats were ice cold. Now you're kind of getting the best of both worlds. You're getting legitimate starting pitching and you're getting a legitimate lineup doing exactly what they're paid to do. So there's your positive. Listen, I think that I live in the same kind of world that a lot of Philadelphia sports fans live, which is baseball, when your team is good, is a wonderful sport to have as the soundtrack of summer. I will gladly listen to, oh, here you go. Big Bet Bob says Alec Bohm is, he was at NF, the National League MVP was at plus 1200 odds. I feel like those odds have actually gotten better in the last 2 days, significantly better. Craig, maybe we'll pull those. But as of 2 days ago, plus 12,000 to be NL MVP at DraftKings. I think he's actually in better shape now today than he was 2 days ago. But I digress. Having baseball be a centerpiece of your summer when the team is really good is one of those things that just perpetually lifts your spirits, whereas when the team is dog shit, you hate it because you have no other sport to lean on unless you're an MLS fan and you're a Philadelphia Union fan. Otherwise, it's just baseball. It's a barren wasteland of sports, which is why so many people get upset when the Flyers don't make the playoffs and when the Sixers have an early exit in the playoffs, because you're forced to, probably earlier than expected, have to come to grips with the fact that, like, for all intents and purposes, your sports fandom is about to go on ice for a very long period of time. The good news is that the Phillies, as of right now, I think they're on pace right now to have the best season in franchise history. I believe they're on pace for 106 wins. So if this team is able to keep up some level of play, if they're able to keep that standard high, if they even get remotely decent pitching the rest of the way, and the bats, they don't have to hit like they are right now. They don't have to crush the way that they are right now. But if you're able to get a pretty decently proportionate response from the pitching staff and from the guys at the plate, this should be a happy summer. This should be a season that is oddly reminiscent of, like, let's say that 09 to 2011 run. I keep 08 out just because I don't think anybody expected the Phillies to win the World Series that year. They overperformed, they overachieved, and they won, which was great. But the expectations really did ramp up in 09, in 10, and obviously in 11. This should be a team that you can get behind, and they have a lot of likable personalities on the team. And again, if they're able to stay remotely consistent, then that soundtrack of summer is going to be a really positive one if you're a Philly sports fan. And hopefully we'll be able to get that nasty taste out of your mouth of what will almost certainly be an early exit by the Philadelphia 76ers, probably in game five, if not at some point in that series. Kevin checks in over on YouTube. Only four teams have 19 wins: the Yankees, the Guardians, the Braves, and the Phillies. I don't want to say that the Phillies are able to sense or smell some blood in the water with the Braves, right? But, like, losing Spencer Strider is massive. And they have a good rotation otherwise. But, like, the thing that maybe you get the most excited about, or it's at least the thing that I get the most excited about, is if you're in striking distance of winning the NL East, which would also then mean that you're within striking distance of potentially winning the pennant, right? Maybe this trade deadline turns into something where you do go out and you do make a big splash. because so much of the team is kind of built around like win now or win in the next couple of years, more so than they don't have a ton of guys that you see a lot of long-term potential. They have guys signed to long contracts, but they don't have a lot of guys who are at like the beginning of their career that you can see being here significantly long-term as significant impact players, MVP type players. If you can all of a sudden pour gas on what is already a very hot burning fire, this could be a special season for the Phillies. And listen, I am one of the people who is first to admit that bad baseball pisses me off more than any other sport. The sport I am least likely to want to watch any action of or listen to anything on the radio is baseball when the team is bad. Okay? I make no secret. Basketball is my number one sport to watch. Hockey's maybe number two. Football's in there. I love watching soccer. Baseball is like fifth out of five. But when the team is good, I'm all in. I'll watch every inning of every game. And now we're starting to get into that realm where now I'm finding myself going, all right, now I'm going to use up the couple of hours I have at night to watch a show with my wife. Now it's going to be, we got to watch the Phillies. Or at least I have to have the Phillies on a second screen. And I will tell you that through the first month of the season, the Phillies were decidedly an after-the-fact watch, condensed highlights kind of team. But now all of a sudden, I'm going, this might be it. Maybe this is the year. And you want to kind of suck the life out of every bit that you can. Like you want to get every possible memory, every possible moment that is available to you and feel like you're going on a special ride with a team that really could go deep in the playoffs this year and maybe even represent the National League in the World Series. Craig had this pulled up, so we're going to add this here really quick. Alec Bohm, his odds have improved from plus 12,000 2 days ago for NL MVP all the way to plus 8,000. So if you followed Big Bet Bob's advice and got in on the action 2 days ago, if the very unlikely event were to happen that Alec Bohm were to win the NL MVP, you've already cost yourself potentially $4,000 on a $100 bet by waiting 2 days. I'm not going to encourage you to go bet on Alec Bohm as MVP of the National League. However, I will tell you that if you're looking at betting on sports, Crossing Broad is your home. It's a place you go over. You go take a look at all of the great offers out there right now. A lot of guaranteed bonuses. Craig knows a lot about them because Craig does all of our images on a lot of sites, not just Crossing Broad. Craig, if I brought you onto the show right now and I said, can you name four of the top offers right now in Sportsbook, do you think you could do it? He's saying yes. Do I bring him on? I won't bring him on. His hair does look lovely, but I'm not going to bring him on. But right now, DraftKings Sportsbook, $200 guaranteed bonus with a $5 bet. Bonus bets. FanDuel, $150. Bonus bets. Caesars, $1,000. Bet on Caesars. Second chance bet kind of thing. BetMGM, $1,500. Same thing. There are others out there. You can read all about them. Fanatics has a cool offer. CrossingBroad.com if you're going to go bet on sports. Make sure you go over to CrossingBroad.com, sign up through one of our links, and make sure that Craig gets paid his $385,000 salary. Okay? That's what it's all about. And then Craig, of course, had to do something to make me really sad at the end of the show, highlighting Rhys Hoskins having the same odds at plus 8,000. I haven't looked at Rhys Hoskins' season so far. I have seen that apparently he's gotten over in a big way with Milwaukee, that people like him. Obviously, they like his wife, who's very good on social media and seems to like really kind of throw herself into being part of that fan base. She was really well-liked here. Rhys Hoskins, I think for the most part, was a well-liked player here. Maligned at times, and at times it was pretty fair. But all the best to Rhys Hoskins, who, if nothing else, we saw him piss off the Mets earlier in the season and kept up the Philly mantra of pissing off a New York team. So good for him. Thursday, Kevin Kincaid will be back. Running lead chair. I don't know if I'll be here on Thursday, maybe. Or maybe I'll take a page out of Kinker's book and I'll go away for a day. But maybe not. Who knows? Kinker's back Thursday. I don't know who he's bringing on the show. I have absolutely no clue. Maybe it'll be somebody exciting. Maybe it won't. I have no idea. I assume that if he brings them on the show, they're going to be good. So make sure that you subscribe to Crossing Broadcast wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora. Amazon Music, YouTube Music, wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, if you haven't done so already and you're watching this show, which love you and thank you and appreciate you. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure you subscribe to Crossing Broad on YouTube. Then like the video, share the video, subscribe to the channel, ring the little bell so you get notified whenever this show goes live, whenever a new episode of Crossed Up, a Phillies podcast drops, which I believe they're going to be recording or they've already recorded or something. I have to imagine, although the Phillies won, so they can't do the thing like where they only record after a loss and they're negative. I think that like Big Bet Bob and Anthony have been put in this weird position where they have to talk about Phillies wins and they don't know how to react to it. But it's a great show if you want to get some in-depth analysis from very good Phillies minds and baseball minds. So you make sure you ring the bell on YouTube so you get notified when their show goes up as well. So for Craig on the other side of the glass, for Kinker, who will be back on Thursday, I'm Russ. Thanks so much for listening to, or maybe even watching, Crossing Broadcast, your favorite Philadelphia sports podcast. We'll be back here on Thursday. Everybody have a great rest of your week. I'll talk to you soon.